All right, awesome. So today we are talking about advanced hemodynamic monitoring. So I'm trying to take a rather complex subject and simplify it as much as possible. So there are four factors really that affect hemodynamic conditions. One is intravascular volume. The other is myocardial contraction, heart rate, and vasoactivity. So we'll start with cardiac output, which is your heart rate times your stroke volume. And normally this is 60 to 130 milliliters per beat. And it's a marker of delivery of oxygen to your tissues. So we really care about flow to the tissues, because if tissues don't get oxygen, what do?
They die.
Mm-hmm. And so our cardiac output is used to guide our treatment. And it is really important to understand the difference between preload and afterload. Preload is the end diastolic volume, which is at the beginning of systole. So we're measuring a volume with our preload, how much is in the tank. And afterload is the ventricular pressure at the end of systole. So it's the squeeze on the hoses. And how do we measure this? The gold standard in most places, most centers, is gonna be with a pulmonary artery catheter. And so the way that this is put in to the heart is it is floated through your right atrium, through the right ventricle, and then sits in the opening of the pulmonary artery. And so as you go through right atrium, right ventricle, the pulmonary artery, you'll notice that there are pressure changes along the way and differences in waveforms along the way. And then finally, because there's a balloon on the end of this catheter, it kind of floats through so that it'll eventually occlude the pulmonary artery all the way, and then you'll get your pulmonary artery wedge pressure.
Do you know where Dr. Swan was when he came up with the idea of the pulmonary artery catheter?
I do not know.
He was sailing.
Well, that is, yes, because then you'd have the sails that move the boat.
Exactly. And that's how he came up with this idea of getting into the RV and then inflating the balloon or I guess they do it in the right atrium, mm-hmm. but basically having it sail into the pulmonary artery.
Yes.
And that was Dr. Swan. He did that in California. It was like in the 60s.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I didn't know that. Fun fact.
Fun fact.
Fun fact of the day. So the way that we determine the cardiac output is done in the past by thermodilution, but today's catheters now use a thermal filament within the catheter to measure the thermal energy. And so it's a continuous cardiac output measurement that you'll see. So what are the indications for a pulmonary artery catheter? There's shock of all types. Assessment of the cardiovascular function and response to the treatment. So you're giving medications, are they working? You're giving fluid, are they working? Assessment of pulmonary status, assessment of your fluid requirement, and then perioperative monitoring. So you'll see this a lot, especially in cardiovascular surgeries where pressure differences are really, really important on both sides of the heart. What are the disadvantages? We all know that any invasive line is at risk for infection. And as soon as you introduce something that is foreign to the body, it'll start forming a fibrin sheath or like a biofilm on it. And that puts you at risk for not only infection, but also increased risk of thrombosis. Just the sheer nature of floating the catheter through the right atrium, right ventricle, can cause some irritation in the myocardium and put you at risk for arrhythmias. And then keeping that pulmonary artery wedge pressure measuring for too long, greater than like 15 seconds, it puts you at risk for pulmonary artery infarct. And even worse, if you overinflate that balloon over the 1.5 milliliter range, it can put you at risk for rupturing the pulmonary artery. So those are really really bad things to happen. But the most common thing that happens in the nursing world, at least, is malpositioning. So it'll either be advanced too far or more often something will get pulled or the catheter won't be locked into place. And so it'll get pulled out a little bit. And then you have to come call someone in and get it repositioned, which is always kind of a pain. And so not very fun to deal with. But the advantages is that it allows for maximum monitoring. You can get so many measurements from the catheter, and there's multiple access points. So if you're infusing a lot of fluids, if you're giving vasopressors or inotropes or anything, you have a lot of access points to be able to do that from. So that's really great. But keep in mind that our patients who usually need a PA catheter also are pretty sick. And so they'll usually have some other kind of invasive line, like a central line or something that'll give even more access points. Or, you know, maybe they'll just have peripheral lines and multiple of them. But regardless, they'll need something else as well. Clinical applications. For the basic parameters that the PA catheter is going to measure directly are the CVP, the PA pressure, so your pulmonary artery pressure, your pulmonary artery occlusive pressure, which is the wedge pressure, and your cardiac output. But then those numbers, using some sophisticated calculations, will give you the derived parameter. So your cardiac index is actually taking your cardiac output and applying body surface area to accurately make sure that we're accounting for your size. So, for example, someone who's, 4'2" and weighs 110 pounds is not going to have the same cardiac needs or cardiovascular needs as someone who is, 6'4" and 300 pounds. So accounting for body surface area matters. You can also do this, index the stroke volume. So you can measure the stroke volume off of the PA catheter, but then index it, index your systemic vascular resistance, things like that. So again, all of these parameters to the right are things that are derived from the PA catheter, not direct measurements. Normal values are really important to understand because you have to know what normal is to understand what abnormal looks like. Mm-hmm. So for your right atrial pressures, those are normally going to be around 2 to 8 millimeters of mercury, whereas your ventricular pressures are going to be a little bit higher than that, but it's not going to be as high as your blood pressure is going to be, because that's actually looking at arterial pressures, and the right side of the heart is a low pressure, is the low pressure side of the heart. Your cardiac output is normally 4 to 8 liters per minute, and indexed for your body size, normal is going to be 2.5 to 4.3 liters per minute per meter squared. For PA pressures, normal systolic is 20 to 30 millimeters of mercury, whereas this is a PA diastolic pressure, 8 to 12, and your wedge pressure is going to be around 8 to 12 as well. So let's try and keep this simple. Think about the cardiovascular system as pump, tank, pipes, and flow. And so the way that we measure how effective the pump is by measuring the ejection fraction. So you'll get an echocardiogram to do that. And that's gonna tell us, is it contracting the way that it's supposed to? Do we have enough force for us to pump the blood out of the tank? The tank is gonna be what's filling up the heart. So you're gonna measure this by your pulmonary artery occlusive pressure, so your wedge pressure, which is gonna tell you the preload of the left side, and your CVP, which tells you the preload of the right side of the heart. And then we all know that you have your preload that has to then be pumped out and overcome the force on the backside of the heart, which is the afterload. And your systemic vascular resistance is going to be the measurement that you're gonna have to overcome to get the fluid out of the tank, so to speak. And then flow is measured by your cardiac output and your stroke volume. So this is kind of on a macro level, a big level, high level overview. So what do we do about patients with hypotension? If they're hypovolemic, Some of the things you're going to see are a low CVP, a low wedge pressure, low cardiac index, but then a high systemic vascular resistance index, because the body's going to try and compensate. And so it's going to try and speed up the flow out of the tank that is actually not full. So you'll consider a fluid challenge for these patients. For those who are cardiogenic, you'll have a high CVP and or wedge pressure, a low cardiac index, and you'll also see the high systemic vascular resistance because your pump isn't working effectively. So you're going to consider inotropes. You might consider something that will decompress the heart so that there's not so much fluid in the tank, because the fluid's going to overflow backwards into the lungs. So you'll consider those kinds of options. For your person who has vasogenic issues, like maybe they're septic and so they've got very leaky capillary beds and everything is hanging out in the third space, you'll see low CVP, high cardiac index, because we have a very, very low systemic vascular resistance. So all of your fluid that would be in the tank is kind of sitting out in the periphery. And so for these patients, you consider a vasopressor. So what about your mixed venous oxygen saturation? Why do we care about that? Because not only are you caring about macro circulation, you also want to consider micro circulation and actually getting to the tissue level. And your mixed venous oxygen saturation is directly measured from your pulmonary artery blood, and it's a marker of the balance between oxygen delivery and consumption. So whenever you have a decreased SVO2, you're going to think anything that's increased consumption. So maybe we have a fever, we're in pain, we are hypoxic, or we're anemic, we don't have enough hemoglobin to carry the oxygen, we're really agitated, something like that is going to decrease your SVO2. And the opposite is true if you have an increased SVO2, which means that you have decreased consumption. So this is basic economics, supply and demand, basically. So with your increased SVO2, generally that's, we've sedated the patient, we've paralyzed them, maybe they have cyanide toxicity, so they can't actually offload their oxygen to the tissues, or we've given them the appropriate respiratory support that the patient needs to bring up what was a low SVO2, and now it's normalized. I love this little cartoon that basically describes microcirculation in a very easy to understand way. So basically your lungs are tanking up your hemoglobin molecules with oxygen. And so your arterial oxygen content is at 100%. And then your heart has to pump that out and deliver it to the tissues. But your tissues have a demand for the oxygen. And so they're going to consume about 25% of whatever oxygen is on the hemoglobin molecules and sends it back up again to cycle back through the heart. And so your normal SVO2 is 75%. So it's a fun little picture to talk about supply versus demand. How do you measure the flow? You can do that through the PA catheter, like I said, or there's also minimally invasive measures that I'll talk about a little bit, touch on. And then the non-invasive measures, which I'm gonna leave for Tammy to discuss, to determine how are you going to measure your cardiac output. One of the minimally invasive measures you can use is pulse pressure or contour analysis. And basically it's looking at your, or hypothesizing that your stroke volume is proportional to your arterial pulse pressure, and it will measure stroke volume and SVR with each beat, which is kind of cool. The great thing about this that has been used in practice when I was at the bedside is that it measures the stroke volume variation and can predict whether you need fluids versus pressors. And so if our stroke volume variation was less than 20%, we would give pressors because we would assume that the tank was full. If it was over 20%, then we would assume that the patient was dry and we would try a fluid challenge for those patients. But the caveat is patients have to be vented. They have to have a regular rhythm. And that's kind of how you would know that it was accurate. Some examples of the minimally invasive procedure or measures to measure cardiac output, you have the auto-calibrated systems like FlowTrack Vigileo, PulsioFlex, Lidco, externally calibrated systems, and then systems that are completely uncalibrated and they're connected to your standard indwelling ART line, like your FlowTrack sensor. Tammy will go into some of these a little bit more in depth. And so everybody has been with a patient and they've seen waveforms like this. So what do you think that does if you're trying to measure your cardiac output off of an arterial line?
I think for pulse contour analysis, it's a problem.
It is a problem. It's going to make it inaccurate, right? So that is one of the major, major disadvantages of the pulse pressure analysis measure or way of measuring cardiac output, because it's relying heavily on an accurate arterial waveform, right? Under or over dampened waveforms are bad. And it's also reflective of forward flow only. So if you have any kind of artifact like that from a balloon pump, or if you have aortic regurgitation, it's going to make this very inaccurate as well. So for those patients, you would want to try something different to measure cardiac output. So here is just kind of a little practice scenario, just very basic. So you've got this 68-year-old male who's admitted to the ICU. He had a non-STEMI. He's medical management only. He had gone to the cath lab and comes back. They can't do anything about it, but he had had some hypotension in the cath lab, so they left a PA catheter in. He didn't need to be intubated. He's only on 40% face mask, and he's currently has the hemodynamics listed below. So 9:30, his blood pressure is 82 over 48 with your MAP of 59. Your pulse is 126. His cardiac output was 3.1, index of 1.9. Stroke volume was only 25. His PA pressure's 22 over 11 with a wedge pressure of 7. CVP is 2, and his systemic vascular resistance was 1470 dynes. The doc decides, well, let's give him 250 cc's, and we're going to do that quickly and see what's going on, if this helps him. And at 10 a.m., his readings were that on the right, with his blood pressure slightly improved, MAP improved to 63, pulse was 130, his cardiac output and cardiac index went from 3.1 to 3.2, and then 2 liters respectively. Stroke volume was 25 still, PA pressure 26 over 16 with a wedge pressure of 10 and a CVP of 5. And an SVR of 1450. Now, would you say for this patient that was adequate for him?
I would say the treatment was inadequate, but the response was positive.
Was positive, right?
I would say that 250 was.
He needs more volume.
Exactly. So that's
significantly, yeah.
Exactly what the doc decides next. So we're going to give another 750 cc's over an hour. And based off of the response at the 11 o'clock readings, was it effective? And why or why not?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, that's clear it was. But I do see a potential problem brewing. But, you know, I mean, I think the CVP is kind of high off of just another 750 to jump from 5 to 14. But there's been a positive response of blood pressure, pulse rates reduced. Output is increased, and the PAD actually doesn't look that. I mean, the PAD looks fine. It's actually gone down a little bit, but the CVP jump from 5 to 14 seems a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'd be a little concerned about the guy's RV.
Correct. And so that's kind of how we use the.
I did. I, that was correct. Did. I did good.
You did good. So you did good.
Yay.
Yes. Yes. So, yes.
I was stressed. I was under pressure. I can't get this wrong.
So that's exactly how you use your knowledge of what's normal and what's abnormal to guide treatment. And you see, what does the trend look like? Mm-hmm. We're not always going to take one set of numbers and say, we've done it, we fixed them. We're mm-hmm. going to look at the total picture and we're going to use what we know to be normal to treat what's abnormal.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense.
So with that, I might have gone a little fast.
a little, but that's okay. So, hey guys, do you want to, how about if we go ahead, since I know yesterday you had said, because we're going to still have a discussion afterwards. Well, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
And then we can maybe do a short break and then we can go from there. So, placement, you know, with showing us those waveforms, arterial waveforms, we've all seen it many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. And in the operating room, it's very frustrating because, of course, the patient's arms are down by their side, they're tucked. Mm-hmm. And when they put in those little short radial arterial lines, you know, about this long, any pressure on it, or if they just don't have it really placed well, or they have any kind of peripheral vascular mm-hmm. disease of any sort, or just a really small vessel. And they lean on it, we lose our pressure. Mm-hmm. Of mm-hmm. course, when we're on pump, we have a continuous flow. Our pumps mm-hmm. are historically continuous flow. So we don't have even a waveform to look at. All we know is our mean is 30, mm-hmm. but is it really 30? And then we try to come off pump and the waveform looks terrible with the pressure is really low. Everybody's talking about wanting to get out the rocket fuel. And the next thing you know, it's like, whoa, wait a minute here. My pressure back here mm-hmm. is a whole lot higher in terms of the mean than what you have up there. And they'll put another line in the femoral to look great. Line placement's so important. Mm-hmm. Why do we have such short, poorly placed radial arterial lines historically in the ICU and not something you can put it in radially, but have it be a much longer catheter that's up closer to the brachiocephalic?
I don't know the exact answer to that question, but I would assume that it's such a mobile placement and you could end up with arterial damage and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature because the patient
constantly doing this. But it's in there anyway.
But if it's only about an inch, it's not as likely to cause.
Of course, put an arm board on it and, you know, do that or put it in higher. What about putting it in higher? Maybe it'd be harder to do, but with ultrasound, it shouldn't be as hard. Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, you know, I just think that it's an interesting problem because, I mean, your experience as an ICU mm-hmm. nurse, is this a problem that anyone else who's watching out here that spends time in the ICU sees and feels the same anxiety?
Yes, your patient has to be pretty immobile for a radial art line to work. But the same thing happens with the femoral lines. Mm-hmm. They start curling up their legs and all of a sudden you don't have a good waveform. And so a lot of times in the ICU, you're doing, non-invasive checks
like
just to see if they
pressures mm-hmm, every
to see
hour
if they
or something
correlate with your arterial line, because it's really important that that you know what that blood pressure is, because it's going to affect everything that you do.
It's like a big deal.
It is mm-hmm. a really big deal.
You know, yet it's so poorly done. And for how many years, decades, mm-hmm. that we've had chronic poor arterial pressure, continuous arterial mm-hmm. pressure readouts. I mean, it's kind of like just a common problem that we've had for, I mean, in the 40 years I've been doing this, I've seen it.
Yeah.
You know, from 40 years ago. And we still haven't figured it out and fixed it because it is a chronic problem.
Well, and if you're treating, specifically when we're on pump, if you're treating that with a presser and you don't need to be treating that with a presser, you're doing a lot of damage.
You are.
Actually, I saw a patient one time actually have a very bad outcome secondary to that very problem. They were, the arterial line pressure was not reading properly, but no one recognized that that was the actual issue. And they were pouring Neo, Levo, Vaso in at massive doses to get a blood pressure. And that patient had a very big stroke and didn't survive the procedure because of that.
Yeah. Well, I think you can also have the opposite effect too. I had a case recently where the pressure was reading low on pump and I had already given, you know, a stick or two. And mm-hmm. I was like, okay, we're not getting a response. Something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
but my anesthesia was not concerned. Oh, it's fine. It's better than that. But really doing nothing to investigate if it's better than that. So then you worry about hypoperfusion.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, right. If you have a very, very low SVR, it doesn't do well for distal perfusion. That's not good.
Right.
Either way is not good.
The point is it needs to be addressed as best you can during that time period.
Yes, I completely agree. I think the real question, and I think the topic that maybe we need to really explore is how do we continue to operate with a lack of confidence in the numbers that we're looking at? You know, that if we're supposed to be, we're monitoring the patient, and if we have a lack of confidence in something that should, chronically, that should be addressed. Because no one has ever, like I said, I don't know, no one's ever addressed it. So on the on your filling pressures, patients on ECMO, PA catheter is out the window.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not helping you any.
Not helping at all.
CVP, not going to help you too much.
Nope.
Or won't it? Will it, if you're on VV ECMO, will that affect your CVP? I mean, you may have flow jetting against the catheter line, but... but if you don't have that happening and you have it positioned in a place where even though the blood is moving around in there, the blood's normally moving around in there, right? Mm-hmm. The pressure should be the pressure because it has to do with the chamber size and the relative tension that's being applied to it. So does VV ECMO really affect our CVP?
I think it would depend on your catheter placement.
And I also think it depends on your flow.
Yeah.
Well, why? If the normal cardiac output is, if that patient's cardiac output is 6 liters, then there's 6 liters a minute that's going through that right atrium. So if we're just taking it out and running it through an oxygenator, running it back in at 5 liters, and their native cardiac output 6 liters, we're not even getting all of it, probably closer to 4 liters. So does it affect it? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm trying to think, and I'm kind of thinking that it doesn't. And I want to know now because I don't really know. So now I want to know. Now, VA ECMO, I think that the number is going to be the number. I think it's an accurate number because, again, I think it's measuring the relative tension of the chamber. But it's not reflective of what the actual CVP would be if we weren't on ECMO.
Correct.
So we're
it's
emptying, right.
Yeah.
We're empty, right. It is a different number. Because we're on more on pump, the atrium is completely collapsed, the CVP is zero. We see the CVP up there of 0 or 1.
All the time.
Yeah. We're happy.
Yeah.
But we're happy because we know the heart's empty.
Right.
Right. Which is what we're trying to do with, on the right side anyway, in the with ECMO. But it's interesting because you can't really use the non-invasives, you'll talk about that, on ECMO. I don't think. Well, maybe VV you can.
I don't know. I had a lot of trouble finding actual, a lot of articles said caution when you've got other circulatory, you know, devices. But I had trouble finding a lot of studies that were like actual studies that were done for that purpose.
So don't preempt your talk too soon because you're next. You're next.